And of course, I'll be back in Los Angeles on the Monday show. I hope all of you have a delightful Easter, by the way. And I'll tell you a little bit more about the weekend schedule as we get close to Friday. Lots going on Friday. Lots. The prediction of Dimitri, the channeler of the devil. We'll talk a little bit about that because he expected something big on or before Good Friday, which is this Friday. We'll talk about some weird wonder hotlines and a number of other things. And also, don't forget, get your taxes filed in time. I'll be back in a moment with our special guest tonight, Dr. Ken Hansen. Next hour, we'll open up the phone lines as well with him. So don't touch your dial. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie, Dr. Ken Hansen, our guest, as we talk about the incredible story, of course, the Gospel of Judas. Ken, let's take some time this hour, if we can, to talk about what really happened as this planet was formed. Who came down here? What did they do? And the fact that they were cannibals. I mean, this is an incredible story all by itself. What can you share for us here?
Yeah, we have so many texts that were literally banned from the Bible, just kicked out, excluded, not accepted by religious authorities, religious and political leaders, just didn't want these texts accepted, and yet they're there. They were copied from time to time through the ages, and we keep getting more of them that, in fact, illumine various passages of the biblical text that are so sparse. Now we've got additional information about Earth's earliest ages. One of my specialty areas is, of course, the Dead Sea Scrolls, which is another amazing Indiana Jones saga. These things surfaced out of the blue, out of nowhere, in 1947, and contain copies of at least fragments of every book in the Hebrew Bible, except one, that's the book of Esther. But additionally, there are thousands and thousands of fragments of non-biblical texts. Some of them we've known existed, some of them we never knew existed. And to piece this library together, in fact, illumines Earth's earliest ages in ways that we never imagined before. One of my research projects, scholarly research projects, is to ask, what did the book of Genesis look like to the earliest generations of the Israelites? Did it look exactly the way it does now, or were there things that didn't quite make the cut as the ages passed? And with the material from the Dead Sea Scrolls, we can now fit in, as it were, between the verses, whole passages that you won't find in your Bibles, for example, having to do with a race of apparently giants who were spawned by angelic beings. If we look at the fifth chapter of the book of Genesis, chapter 5, verse 28, it talks about the patriarch Lamech. It says he lived 182 years and became the father of a son and called his name Noah. We've all heard of Noah. Mm-hmm. But now, piecing together, if we take these scraps from the Dead Sea Scrolls and fit them into Genesis, there's an entire passage that we could add directly after that verse. And it goes like this: however, when Lamech, that's this patriarch, was convinced in his heart that his wife's pregnancy came about through the heavenly watchers, the holy ones, and the giants. What on earth? And we piece some more fragments together, and we're told that while the sons of men multiplied, fair and lovely daughters were born to them, and the watchers. These extraneous texts refer to them as the watchers. That's interesting language, isn't it? Those sons of heaven were attracted to them and lusted for them, said to one another, come, let us seek out the daughters of men, rear sons for ourselves. The text goes on and says that they reared this generation, this breed of giants, of half-breeds, and they taught them witchcraft, magic spells, how to cut roots and herbs for their conjurations. They gave birth to the giants, who grew up to be 3,000 cubits tall. None were able to provide for their rapacious appetites, and so they consumed the produce and the labor of men. And therefore, the giants, the Nephilim, that's the Hebrew word that we do find in the Hebrew Bible, in the book of Genesis, but it just gives us this one little verse and then goes on. This whole passage is now elaborated. The Nephilim, literally that word in Hebrew means the fallen ones. That's what that word means. The root nafal means to fall. So they conspired to kill the men and eat them, performed sinful acts. And everyone started disclosing these secrets to their wives, as a result of which many people were struck dead. And at that time, Michael, Sariel, Raphael, and Gabriel look down from the holy places of the heavens, and they decide that they must do something, to make a long story short, to annihilate the offspring of the watchers from among humankind. And God commissions them to annihilate this race of half-breeds before they destroy the rest of humanity. Go bind them in chains in the earth's great valleys for 70 generations until their judgment day.
What an incredible story. How many of them do you think there were, Ken?
We're told that there were several hundred. The text might even tell us specifically. I'd have to go search for that. But
now, why are you doing that, too? When you said 3,000 cubic feet tall.
3,000 cubits.
Now, how tall is this?
Well, a biblical cubit is about from the elbow
inches,
to the end of the hand.
Yeah, it's about 18 inches. So
yeah,
4,000 feet tall?
That's what it says, 3,000 cubits tall. That's unbelievable.
4,000-foot person?
That's what it says.
Where are the bones for something like that, huh?
You got to ask.
Yeah.
You know, of course, maybe they found some bones in that part of the world and began to wonder, where do these things come from?
4,000 feet, that's a big person.
Yeah, that is definitely. That is definitely. Of course, many of these numbers in the biblical text are symbolic. And I wouldn't, as a scholar, say, now we have to take all of this literally. These things are mysteries. They're communicated as mysteries. And you take it for what they are. It doesn't necessarily say these are aliens either, or spacecraft. You know, I'm giving you permission to go there.
Well, you know what? Are you familiar with the Nag Hammadi?
Absolutely.
Sure. John Lash, a former guest of ours, he was talking about what he described as the Archons, Archons, pretty close to what you were saying. And he believes that the people were abducted by what he calls predatory aliens called the Archons.
The Archons, right.
Archons. So it's an interesting analogy there.
Yeah, the predatory. Predatory. Yes. That is a very ancient tradition. And the bottom line is that in the ancient world, that this was the actual original sin, quote unquote, that brought about the flood. And this is astounding to most moderns who just read the traditional text and say, well, original sin, that was when Adam and Eve ate the apple and sin exploded on the earth and the flood was sent. That is not what rank and file ancients believed. The original sin was this coming down, this descent, this cohabiting.
Did Paul warn of the teachings of the Gnostics as being false teachings? Were they branded as heretics in that day?
Oh, my. It was explosive. It was bitter, back and forth. And Paul especially damned the Gnostics as abominable heretics. And that is why, in fact, so many of these texts didn't make the cut. So many of them were banned from the Bible because they found something in them that sounded Gnostic. Some of the texts are clearly in the Gnostic category, but Dead Sea Scrolls, for example, these are Jewish texts. They're written in Hebrew. And yet, there are certain ideas that link these all together. And many of the keepers of the canon, as I call them, the religious leaders who decided which books make the cut, simply decided, it sounds a little bit on the Gnostic side, and being captivated by Paul's very powerful personality, they won the day.
The era, I think, a couple thousand years ago, I'm glad I'm not around in those days. It sounded like a pretty violent period on this
planet. Violent and volatile. But extremely fascinating. It was diversity, and that's the word for ancient Christianity. There wasn't an orthodoxy. There was a heterodoxy. And I think one of the big problems that we have is trying to say that there's only one meaning out there that's acceptable, and we have to decide what that meaning is, and everybody has to espouse to that meaning, or you're doomed as a heretic. That's really sad, because clearly the earliest Christians didn't have one meaning.
Did the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls alter or convince us anything that we didn't already know?
It was another earth-shattering event that fundamentally changed the entire landscape of biblical scholarship, of the development of ancient Judaism, of the very beginnings of Christianity. It's a whole world that we never knew existed before. Earth-shattering. And out of the blue, in the middle of the 20th century, found by a Bedouin shepherd boy in some caves opposite the Dead Sea, lowest spot on the earth, in the middle of the Judean desert, stumbles upon these crumbling parchments. He doesn't even know what they are. And as with the Gospel of Judas, they're picked up by an antiquities dealer, they're passed from hand to hand, put on the market, sold. And finally, after a lengthy period of time, years in many cases, decades in other cases, deciphered, many of them had to be pieced together as an enormous jigsaw puzzle, and we find that in fact they contain hundreds of texts, some of them Gnostic, quote-unquote Gnostic. We call them Apocrypha and Pseudepigrapha. These are the books that didn't make it. As well as entire manuals, rule books, apocalyptic war books about the end of the age, one major war scroll that we didn't even know existed suddenly surfaces in the middle of the 20th century.
Isn't it true that they have not deciphered all of the Dead Sea Scrolls?
They're all out there now and in the open. The fragments that I'm talking about, the enormous jigsaw puzzle, thousands, tens of thousands of these fragments were sequestered for some 40 years in the basement of the East Jerusalem Rockefeller Museum, and no one was allowed access to them, or even photocopies of these very important texts, these fragments, except just a select handful of scholars. No one could see them. And that, of course, gave rise to a lot of theories and conspiracy theories as well.
Oh,
what are you,
sure.
What are you hiding in there? What kind of incendiary material do you have in the basement of the Rockefeller Museum? It took a long time. And in fact, lawsuits were filed in the end. Eventually, the logjam broke, and this material began trickling out steadily and then in a flood. And in fact, it's out there. It's changed everything we know about the biblical world, and some pretty astounding material.
What are the odds, Ken, that there might be more scrolls out there somewhere?
As I mentioned at the start of the broadcast, I get asked this question, and I kind of chuckle to myself and say, yes, I suppose it's possible that there is more material out there. And yet deep inside, I'm thinking, nah, we found everything that could be found has been found. The odds against it are so astronomical. And then what happens? Within a week, we come across the Gospel of Judas. So at this point, I have to say, yeah, it's entirely possible that we'll find even more.
Well, you know, as we've just discussed with the Gospel of Judas, it was found years ago, but we just find out about it now. I wonder what else is out there, Ken. I mean, I wonder if the Ark of the Covenant has been found, and we just haven't been told about it yet.
Well, I know of one. Let's call him renegade archaeologist who believes that the famous Dead Sea copper scroll contains clues to the whereabouts of the Ark of the Covenant. He's been looking for it for a long time. One of the Dead Sea Scrolls is completely different from all of the others. Most all of them were composed on parchment material called vellum. It's the skin of kosher animals that's sewed together very much like modern Torah scrolls are sewn together and inscribed today for synagogues. Same materials used, same techniques, but one Dead Sea scroll was completely different, found in the 1950s by the archaeologists, again in one of those caves. The contents were pounded into sheets of highly refined copper, the copper scroll. One piece of copper then was riveted into the next, rolled up into a scroll and abandoned in that cave for two millennia. And when it was finally sawed into pieces, it was the only way they could open it because the copper had oxidized, they found inscribed on it an inventory, believe it or not, of buried treasure. More than 200 tons of gold and silver, as well as consecrated items, artifacts, apparently from the ancient temple of Jerusalem. And could we not be looking here at possible whereabouts of the Ark of the Covenant? As I mentioned, one, let's call him renegade archaeologist, believes that that is in fact a possibility. You never know, though the biblical world can so surprise us, and it's always changing.
This cubic thing is driving me nuts, Ken. I want you to basically tell us this again. I'm beginning to wonder if they were talking about the spacecraft that they showed up in.
Who knows? It says that the women became pregnant by the watchers. Now, I'm reading my own retranslation, actually, of these ancient texts from the original language. Then I've smoothed out into a more of a modern, lively, semi-paraphrase. The women became pregnant by these watchers. They gave birth to the giants who grew up to be, up to 3,000 cubits tall. They were born according to the laws of nature and grew up at a constant rate. Moreover, they were consumed. They consumed the produce of the labor of men. None were able to provide for their rapacious appetites. Therefore, the giants, the Nephilim, conspired to kill the men and eat them. Now, according to the story, Noah's father is himself concerned that Noah might be one of these offspring, born according to the laws of nature and yet grew up at a constant rate to become a giant. And so we're told in one of these books that got banned from the Bible that Noah's father, Lamech, goes upward, an upward ascent into the heavens to find his father, Methuselah, to ask him about Noah. Is this a normal child or is this the offspring of one of the watchers? This whole incredible story is related to us.
I've got to believe that could have been a typo passed down, maybe 30 cubics. That would make them 45 feet tall. Now,
yeah,
that's a giant.
Although they didn't, you're talking about ancient Hebrew letters here, so you're not looking at Arabic numerals. I would have to go and consult the original text, but I'm almost sure it says Shloshim Elif. I'm sorry, Shalosh Elif, that is 3,000 written out.
But an earth woman would give birth to a little kid who could become then 3,000 feet tall?
That's the story, would be born according to the laws of nature. And there are other mysterious Dead Sea Scroll fragments. Most people don't know these exist, but one of them is about Noah, specifically about Noah, trying to prove that he's not one of the giants, one of these strange offspring.
Man, that is weird. We'll be back with you, Ken, in just a moment. On Coast to Coast AM, I'm George Norrie. Next hour, we'll open up the phone lines for you, give you an opportunity to talk with our special guest, Dr. Ken Hansen. Yeah, the Filament Book Club is available to you. All you have to do is go to the coasttocoastam.com website, and they have up there for you, because they're going to give you a free electronic book when you become a member of their club. You can download books on your computer or telephone. They've got the information for you on the Gospel of Judas. The Filament Book Club on Coast to Coast AM. Ken, tell me a little bit about the Essenes, because I want to get into some of the treasures that they apparently had and where it might be. But what can you tell us about them, this sect?
Ancient group of pious Judeans described in vivid detail by the ancient Jewish historian Josephus Flavius in the first century of the Common Era, that is A.D., all we knew about was what Josephus told us about them, a pietistic group who cultivated a sense of vision that gave them foreknowledge of future events revealed by God, who apparently had incredible powers of healing, who also, by the way, according to Josephus, lived regularly to be over 100 years. They were centenarians, according to Josephus, by virtue of their diet and the regular course of life they exercised also. There were little pockets of these groups scattered all around ancient Judea in the days of Jesus and John the Baptist and King Herod and the Romans, and there seems to have been a headquarters of the group that literally separated from the rest of society, went out to the corner, the northwest corner of the Dead Sea, and established an alternate society, literally, a community of their own on the edge of eternity, as it were, awaiting the apocalypse, the messianic age. But we didn't have any of their writings, only what the ancient historian Josephus told us about them until the Dead Sea Scrolls surfaced. And scholars immediately were arrested by these documents, and they looked at the contents of these scrolls found in the middle of the 20th century and compared them with what Josephus had already written two millennia ago, and they said, by golly, we've got the library now of the ancient Essenes.
Did they amount to vast treasures, and if so, where might they be?
All we know is we've got this mysterious copper scroll, more than 200 tons of gold and silver, consecrated items from the sacred temple in Jerusalem. Now, what is this? Scholars were puzzled by that immediately. And by the way, when they first deciphered the copper scroll back in the 1950s, they dropped everything, ran out into the desert with metal detectors, I'm serious, looking for the treasure, because the scroll actually gives clues as to where this stuff is buried, out in the desert and in the city of Jerusalem. They went on a major excavation trying to find the treasure, found nothing. And the questions persist. Was this whole thing just a hoax? Did somebody inscribe this scroll with an expensive material like this for nothing, just as some sort of game? Or maybe somebody found the treasure already at some point in time. But that would really be kind of puzzling and curious because, you know, when treasures did surface in the ancient world, people liked to write about them. We have a lot of ancient historians who wrote about incredible treasures that were found. For example, Cleopatra's treasure was seized on the Mediterranean Sea when her boyfriend, Mark Antony, was defeated by the forces of Octavian. And they took that treasure back to Rome. Everybody knew about it. They wrote about it. It caused a spike of inflation in the city of Rome. You didn't find treasures of that magnitude, and nobody knew about it. So the puzzle still persists. If this thing were real and if nobody has found it, then in fact maybe it is still out there.
I'll always remember the Indiana Jones movies where they had that Knights Templar type person guarding the Holy Grail, and he was surrounded with treasures. And I'm just wondering if that might have been based on the Essenes and in the rumors of their treasures.
Well, we didn't know anything again about the Essene treasures until the copper scroll was found. And we can't even be sure that this was the treasure of the Essenes. It was found in one of these caves near all of the other Dead Sea Scrolls, but nothing on the copper scroll says this is the work of the Essenes, this is the work of the Dead Sea sect. Some have theorized that this, in fact, may have been put there by somebody else entirely, just happens to have been deposited in a cave nearby the Essene headquarters, maybe by folks from Jerusalem who were fleeing from the Romans in those days and decided to hide the temple treasure out in the middle of nowhere. We don't know. It's that kind of a mystery. Personally, I like to think that this was, in fact, the treasure of the Essenes. These people, for a couple of centuries, lived out there in their own community, their own society. They pooled all of their resources. Everything they had, they shared together. They lived along the trade routes, and they bought and sold. They cultivated crops. Over that period of time, they lived very, very frugally, and they amassed treasure. And I like to think, in fact, that this thing is genuine. The very last item in the Copper Scroll talks about a copy of this document. And I'm quoting it now, with an inventory and their measurements and a listing of each thing and other things, unquote. A copy of this document is the last item in the Copper Scroll. So my question is, perhaps, do you suppose that the Copper Scroll that was found was a decoy and that the locations of the treasure are wrong in the one that we found, but that the scroll with the correct locations has never been found, and that's the last item that's listed?
Well, this Friday marks the beginning of a holy period for Christians all around this planet, that being Good Friday through Easter. The episodes that led up through Good Friday and then the resurrection 3 days later, do you believe that those episodes truly occurred, Ken Hansen?
I can tell you that we are in the midst of incredible Jesus research on a scholarly level as has never been before. We know more about the historical Jesus today than we have ever known in two millennia of Christian history. And the beautiful thing is, it's not just Christians involved. As I've already alluded to, there are many Jewish scholars involved in this. And I personally think that we can nail a lot of the events in the life of Jesus as historical. And certainly, Jesus was in Jerusalem right about this time. I was in Jerusalem not long ago leading a group, and I do that from time to time. I'll be leading another one in December. Folks can find out about it on my website. But we've got the location for the crucifixion of Jesus. Whether you're Christian, Jewish, Muslim, whatever you are, we know historically where this event happened, and it's dead on. It's called the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. It's a very dank, dark, musty, early medieval church. A lot of American tourists don't like even getting near the place, and don't like thinking, to be honest, that this is the place where Jesus was crucified. But everything points to that. Everything points to this as being the historical location of the crucifixion of Jesus of Nazareth, and that's staggering.
Is that on Calvary?
It is what we call Mount Calvary. Now, we know exactly where that was in ancient Jerusalem, and there's precious little left of Mount Calvary today because the mother of the Emperor Constantine, her name was Helena, Queen Helena, was a Christian. Constantine was, of course, the Roman emperor who converted to Christianity and changed the whole course of history. His mother went around the Holy Land looking for holy sites, where this event happened, that event happened. Where was Jesus born? We'll plant a church there. Where was the Annunciation to Mary? We'll plant a church there. Most of these locations are bogus. And Constantine's mother, Helena, just asked the locals, where do you think this happened? And whatever they said, that's where she planted a church. Well, lo and behold, the one for Calvary, she got right. She had to have gotten right. As I say, there's not much left of Mount Calvary today because she built a church right on that spot. But there is a small outcropping of bedrock that was in fact there in the first century of the Common Era, and precisely underneath that church are tombs dating from the first century AD exactly as they should have been according to the gospel accounts. It's uncanny. It's staggering. And what I can tell you this, that in spite of all of the divisiveness in ancient Christianity, and they were coming to blows, literally, between Paul's group and the Gnostics. There were other groups we didn't mention, the Ebionites, for example, who were pious Christians, but who didn't believe in the incarnation or that Jesus was divine. They believed he was the Messiah, but not divine. They didn't agree on anything. They were fighting and shouting with each other, but the one thing that they all agreed on, whether you are a Christian or not, whether you believe it or not, they all agreed on the empty tomb. The fact they believed.
It must have been strange, Ken, to be in an era where you could feel that if that was the spot where Jesus was crucified, you could feel that, I bet. You could absolutely feel that.
You get goosebumps. I mean, again, whether you happen to be a Christian or not, there is something very, very historical and extraordinary here at that spot. The surroundings for a Westerner like myself are pretty depressing. This is early Romanesque architecture, dank, dusty, but you know you're in an authentic place.
Is there much talk about the devil on any of these texts, scrolls, anything that has been found?
That's one extraordinary aspect of these books that probably helped get many of them banned, as a matter of fact, especially in the Jewish world. These books we call Apocrypha and Pseudepigrapha. I wrote an entire book called Secrets from the Lost Bible dealing with these banned books, and another one called the Essene Book of Everyday Virtues. If our audience is wondering about these texts I quoted from the book of Genesis, where we can fill them in, you want to head to the website and get hold of these books. But back to our question on the devil, these books do mention powers of evil. They mention, as it were, the force and the dark side, and we even have Darth Vader. We've got a Darth Vader, you bet, we've got a Darth Vader type figure in the Dead Sea Scrolls called the Wicked Priest. That's the only name he's ever given, but he seems to be consumed or driven by a satanic agency. And he is in mortal combat with the apparent leader of the ancient Essenes called the Teacher of Righteousness. Now, that's an interesting title, the Teacher of Righteousness, who lived at some time in the first century B.C. And the two of these characters engage in mortal combat on, of all days, the Day of Atonement, Yom Kippur. And the wicked priest slays the Teacher of Righteousness. I mean, this is right out of George Lucas. Unbelievable. But this is the kind of thing that certain religious leaders, especially in the Jewish world, looked at askance. Because if you start talking about evil power, some evil agency, a satanic figure, and Satan appears by name prominently in many of these banned books, that somehow impinges on the unity of God, on monotheism itself, because the sages started asking, how many gods do we have here, one or two? That was enough to get them banned.
Do you believe the Shroud of Turin is authentic, Ken?
I've just been researching that topic and seem to be of a mind, this is just my opinion, that we might be looking at the work of Leonardo da Vinci. Here's the thing about the Shroud is that we've got carbon dating, and I know that that's called into question as well.
Right.
Maybe the carbon dating is off, but it would have to be pretty majorly off. We don't have anything to suggest that the fact that a fire occurred in Turin, Italy, really could have changed the carbon dating to that extent. Anything can happen in this world, as we know, but the same techniques of carbon dating have been used on the Dead Sea Scrolls, and without question, these are over 2,000 years old. So for my money, if it works on the Dead Sea Scrolls, it ought to work on the Shroud of Turin. I like the Da Vinci idea.
It's very, very possible, though, that even if Da Vinci, let's say, sketched this, painted this, mm-hmm. With his incredible mind of reverse imagery, maybe it was based on something he believed was real.
there are traditions of an image of Jesus that go way back. There are also traditions that Helena, Constantine's mother, found the true cross on the site where the Church of the Holy Sepulchre was built. At that point, as scholars, we just have to stand back and say, well, here's a tradition here, here's a tradition there. Do with this what you will. There's a lot of mysteries out there, that's for sure.
Do they know where the tomb is, perhaps, where Christ was buried for those several days?
We can say where Mount Calvary was, and again, I was just there, led a little group. I never take more than 10 individuals, by the way, because we do intimate tours, but we can get up close and personal with the rock, with Calvary. We know that in the basement, downstairs, we can walk among first century tombs. We cannot say with certainty which one was the tomb of Jesus of Nazareth. But here's the deal. Again, whether you're a Christian or not, the early Christians believed it. They were absolutely convinced that that tomb was empty. You don't go out and turn the world upside down on the basis of something that you know was a lie. So you can debate theology up and down, backwards and forwards. They did then, and people still do today. But what it was all grounded in was an overwhelming belief that this tomb was empty.
Do you believe that at least one of those tombs might be where Jesus' body was placed?
It's entirely possible, yes. Yes, I do. But the thing is, we know that this is an entire cemetery underground. So much of Jerusalem is subterranean. So there's more of it that potentially is still underground. So only a few tombs are actually accessible to us.
Now, you're right. So much of Jerusalem is underground. Why is that? Why a long time ago did they do this?
Because the city has been destroyed umpteen times, perhaps the most devastating destruction by the Roman Empire in the year 70 of the Common Era, when a massive revolt broke out among the Jewish population. These were the ancient Bravehearts in Mel Gibson variety, seriously, shouting freedom, and we want our land. The Romans were not necessarily nice folks. It was a massive revolt, and the Romans put it down with such fury. Josephus describes this in detail. I quote Josephus in my own books, and fit this in with what we read in the Dead Sea Scrolls, which are almost prophesying the course of this disastrous revolt. The ideas of the scrolls had certainly gotten out into the general population, and they were expecting in those days the apocalypse, the end of everything, and that they would be miraculously rescued. Unfortunately, they were not. And the Romans destroyed the city, they destroyed the temple, burned it to the ground. Josephus tells us that some 1,100,000 Jews died in that horrific siege. They were literally eating their own children, some of them. It was that bad.
Oh,
the city was covered in rubble. When you go up to the wall, the western wall, the last vestige of the ancient temple of Jerusalem today, you're standing on about 40 feet of Roman rubble. That's why so much is underground.
Would you like to have lived in that time period?
Yes and no. Not to be part of that revolt.
Stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment. We'll take your phone calls next on Coast to Coast AM.